Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us on The Conversation. It's Aloha Friday, April 5th. Housing solutions. The need is great. Displaced Maui families press for lawmakers to do more. The governor backed off a moratorium on short-term rentals. We get reaction from an association of legal vacation rental owners. We learn about a photography exhibit in Canada that captured a point in time in Lahaina Town that exists no more. And getting up close to our native birds, the next best thing to being there, as we pay homage to the Year of the Forest Birds. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Housing solutions, not easy. The pain of displaced Lahaina residents bubbled over at a recent rally. They are pressing lawmakers to move faster on a fix. HPR's Catherine Kluwet-Pachtel joins us now. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning.
Yeah, so there was a recent march and a rally down there at the Capitol.
There was. So Lahaina Strong is an organization, actually a whole hui of organizations that has been working from day one of the fires to solve this housing crisis, as you mentioned. And they held a rally in Lahaina less than a week ago. And then shortly before that, they did visit the Capitol to make their voices heard and really have that face-to-face with lawmakers just to push, you know, what is so important to them. And one thing that they've been doing through this process is turning to legislative advocacy during this session to turn that, you know, all of that frustration, the anger, the sadness, all of those emotions that Lahaina residents and fire survivors are going through right now, and translating that into action, hoping that and working strongly towards getting several bills pushed through the legislature. They started with, you know, over 130 bills that they were watching and rooting for this session, and those, of course, have been narrowed down through the legislative process. There are, I believe, three or four now that they are strongly pushing for, encouraging testimony, and really getting the community involved in the legislative process, educating people on how to do that. As we know, it's a little bit of a complicated process that, you know, requires close attention and you know, action to submit testimony for those bills. I talked with Jordan Ruidas, who is one of Lahaina Strong's organizers, about that process.
We've all just been working as best as we can together and educating the community. Because, like, if it's the first time for all of us, it's definitely a first time for a lot of people, you know? So really bringing them along the process, helping to, you know, educate them on why we're doing this, how to make their accounts on the, you know, the Capitol website, and prompt them, you know, when testimony is needed, and, you know, give them a little info on, you know, we really like to focus on the small bite-sized pieces, right? Like I said, law is super, it's super hard to read, so we really break it down, but we also provide the link for them to read it themselves in hopes that we just get people engaged in the whole thing. It's been really good, and you can see the bills that we are pushing and are bringing out to the community. The legislators are getting, like, hundreds of emails, so it's working. You know, people are engaging, and I'm getting chicken skin telling you now, like, something that a lot of people don't want to mess around with, and, you know, regular community people are like, oh, I don't like politics, like, they're getting engaged and they're ignited, and I'm really excited to see what changes we can bring about with everybody participating.
And initially, Lahaina Strong, those folks were advocating, you know, for a ban that those short-term rentals be converted to long-term rentals.
Yes, absolutely. So they have been pushing for months for that moratorium on short-term rentals that Governor Josh Green had kind of promised along the way, and you know, they feel like he didn't follow through on that promise at this point. He, you know, as we know, he recently said that he doesn't feel like a moratorium is needed. So a quick review on those numbers, about 1,300 families or around 3,000 individuals are still living in hotels after the Maui fire. And Governor Green says that more than 1,300 units are available currently through FEMA's direct lease program. And so he feels like that is adequate to make sure that the rest of those folks are transferred from hotels into longer-term housing by the summer. And, you know, Lahaina Strong, you know, agrees with those numbers, but a lot of those housing is not in Lahaina. It's not in West Maui. It's elsewhere on Maui. And so what we're seeing now is a lot of the community just really being torn apart. And so they're continuing to push for housing in West Maui. There's a high percentage of short-term rentals that are in that those communities already. And so, you know, being able to see that conversion happen would mean a lot for Lahaina families who really need to stay in that area near jobs, near their schools, near, you know, their entire lives. even though they, you know, they lost everything in the fire, it's still really important for them to be in that community. Here's Courtney Lazo, who is a fire survivor as well as a Lahaina Strong organizer, talking about her community being torn apart and why it's so important for them to stay together.
I'm just going to speak on the experience of what it's like living in the hotels and what it's like for fire survivors that are still in the hotels when you're in Red Cross and you're in FEMA and you're holding on to hope that you can remain in your community. But then you look and 87% of the remaining housing in your community is short-term rentals, and that's being prioritized over the people. And it's hard. It's a hard reality to live with, especially when you're living amongst tourists. I don't think people understand how important it is for the Lahaina community to stay together. And every day, someone's being pushed out of Lahaina. They have to move off island. 60% of our community is gone. How do you expect a community to recover and heal and move forward when the people who make Lahaina, Lahaina, aren't even there anymore? They're moving away. And then you drive through your town and it's burnt down. And you drive through what's not burnt down and it's tourists. And they can stay and sleep safely in your hometown, but you can't. And that's a really hard reality and a hard pill to swallow. We need to keep our community in Lahaina that wants to stay.
Yeah, it's tough. Hard on those folks.
It is. So, you know, right now they're pushing for several bills, as I mentioned. A couple of bills are looking toward those short-term rentals and giving the counties instead of the state power for certain zoning decisions, as well as, you know, longer-term phase-out of short-term rentals that are non-conforming. So, as we know, there are quite a number of illegal short-term rentals that are operating. There's also, listeners have probably heard of the Minatoya list at this point. It's a fairly lengthy list of short-term rentals that were originally workforce housing. And so the effort to convert those back into longer-term housing is the goal for Lahaina Strong. And those bills are making their way through legislature right now. And, you know, these folks have been down at Ka'anapali Beach for months. And Jordan Ruida said if any one of these bills pass, that they will pack up camp and be prepared to call it a win and move on to the next thing for Lahaina Strong. And during Lahaina Strong's recent visit to the Capitol, Senator Angus McKelvey talked about Lahaina residents moving forward and that geographic divide that's being created in the community.
The people are here to put a face onto the ongoing struggles that continue every day and to make very clear that these bills represent a long overdue struggle that has culminated by a disaster into a flashpoint. What is happening now is the state is making it definitively clear that short-term rentals, the zoning, the control therewith is within the auspices of the county entirely. So that the people here don't have to come to Honolulu to petition their government. They can petition their government right in their own backyard where it is. And I got to just say, you know, the stories you're hearing, it speaks to the success of this voluntary dislocation program that has torn this community apart. And I, for one, have not seen a plan to bring our people home, to reunify our people back in their own community. Right now, all I see is a one-way ticket out. And I've seen it in other disasters in other states. 10-20% may be returned. The rest is all brand new. And that's what they're here. Them being here puts a face on that goes far beyond bills, it goes far beyond policy. We have to remain focused on ensuring that this community can be reunited and they can heal and repair and rebuild what was lost to them.
Yeah, so that was pretty tough for Angus McKelvey. Yeah, we chatted with him right immediately after the fire. So it's a tough situation to be in. But thank you so much, Catherine.
Thank you.
We have been talking to HPR's Catherine Kluwet-Pachtel. You can read her stories on our website, HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Stories are the threads that weave our island communities together. From fish pond restoration efforts on Kauai to families recovering after the Maui fires, and more stories in between. HPR's local newsroom brings voices from across the islands to you. Statewide coverage is our commitment to you. Show your commitment to HPR with a monthly gift. Donate today at HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
Hi, I'm Sam Daly Harris, author of Reclaiming Our Democracy. Next time on New Dimensions, I'll be talking about making the difference in the world you've always dreamed of making.
Beginning Sunday morning at 11.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors, Bavarian Motor Experts, and Chaminade University.
Owners of legal vacation rentals across the state were closely watching what Governor Josh Green would do about a ban. And while that threat is not in the forefront, the efforts to phase out short-term rentals haven't gone away, as we just heard talking with Catherine Kluwet-Pachtel. Today we talked to Kelly Lee. She is with the Hawaii Mid and Short-Term Rental Alliance. It has members across the state informed about a year ago, well before the wildfires. Lee stopped by our studios this morning. She says when the wildfires hit, the Alliance reached out to their members and urged them to step up and help the community and help those displaced families. They worried, though, about the proposed moratorium.
It was a relief that he decided not to put a moratorium because we are going to need that housing, especially right now for the people, the workers who are coming to Lahaina that will have to rebuild. We need that housing for them.
I was on a red-eye flight out, and it was packed with construction workers. And one company that I talked to, they were saying that they were having to fly their people in and out every single day as opposed to putting them up, you know, in a house for a week.
Correct. And the hotels, you know, they can be pricey. So a lot of owners did step up, and many gave them for free to survivors and people impacted.
There are still bills that are pending at the legislature, and you know, the Lahaina Strong folks, you know, are pressing for faster solutions and the phase out of vacation rentals. So how do you respond to that?
Well, we do support Lahaina Strong. We do. And we support housing for residents. We are residents. And the important thing is to differentiate a little bit. There are some vacation rentals, but there are also mid and long-term housing that is provided, furnished short and long, mid and long-term rentals. And we need those for transferring military people, for the workers who are gonna rebuild, for film and doctors and medical staff and military. So we have to be sure not to exclude that important housing portion of our islands. Without that, It's going to be a lot harder for people to have this furnished transitional or temporary housing.
Clarify for me. So when you say short and midterm, what do you consider midterm?
So midterm would be like the 30 days to 6 months, because 6 months beyond is long term. So the midterm is not vacation rental. it's that midterm housing. That's 1 month to 6 month. And we do need that stock for this transitional group. And we are on an island chain. So we don't have as many options that a mainland city might have to have that transitional housing. And for people who are moving, they can't just get their stuff delivered the day they want it. They have to come here. They need furnished places. They might have pets or kids. And we need that housing for them.
And here on Oahu, there was a lawsuit that was filed over the mayor's proposal to cap the short-term rentals at 90 days, I believe. And you folks won that round.
We did. And it's important, especially on Oahu, because we have at least 2,500 medical personnel coming in, and their contracts are 6 weeks starting. So they can't do 6 months. They don't know how long they're going to be here. So that's 2,500 alone. And then we also have thousands that were displaced by the Marco Polo fires, by the Red Hill crisis. Those people needed furnished housing, pets, children, and it's not going to be 2 weeks. It could be 2 months, 5 months, 2 years. But without that option, those month-to-month people have no option.
Just to clarify, though, this lawsuit that was lodged against the city, you represent legal vacation owners, vacation rental owners.
We support all legal, short, mid, long-term rentals. Legal. That means abide by the rules, and we're working with the county very closely to help make sure that our industry is a viable industry that supports the islands and supports our residents.
And then as far as the X factor, the illegals that are operating, let's say, in Maui?
We are working, all of us statewide, are working on legitimizing this industry. So we do not want illegal rentals. We want to be able to be held accountable, and we want to help the cities and the counties and the state to be sure that people are following the rules. Our membership, we don't allow illegal members because we want it legal. If you're legal and you're following the rules, then we support that.
Right, because that gives everybody, you know, a black eye.
Right, it makes us all look bad because we're trying to legitimize this portion of our industry. And a lot of people rely on it for a living, and their livelihoods depend on it. And without it, we're worried that if we don't do it right, do it legal, that people will continue to be priced out of paradise and the crisis continues. We don't want that.
Recently, we were talking with Kauai Mayor Derek Kawakami, who shared that the county there collected more taxes from the vacation rental segment versus the hotel rooms. And that was a surprise to me.
Correct. And vacation rentals do provide a very large portion of the budgets in each county. And it is less than hotels. And the short-term and the midterm rentals don't really have the ancillary businesses that a hotel has. Restaurants, shops, stuff like that, that they can earn income on. It's purely the rental, but the taxes are quite high.
Yeah, so the snapshot on each island is a little different, each county.
Yes, every county is different. You know, we have some things in common, but the way our islands are set up are very different, and the way the development has been on each island is very different, where the hotels are or where the whole home rentals are, where the short-term rentals are, the condos. So the makeup of each island is very unique. So we do have to make sure that we treat each island as its own community because they are all different.
I know at one time the city was looking at allowing bed and breakfast in some neighborhoods. Where do you folks stand on that?
We do agree that having bed and breakfast could give local residents, because a B&B on Oahu is where the owner lives on site and rents out a portion of their house. Over 75% of our owners are kupuna, they're above the age of 55. 77% are local residents. This is Oahu I'm speaking of. So they need that income so that they don't have to leave. And it's a way to stay. And costs are rising. Everyday cost of living is on the rise and continues to go up. And people want to age in place. They don't want to move. And so that gives them a way to subsidize their retirement income.
I think the whole pushback on vacation rentals is because we were seeing these unintended consequences. You know, in my neighborhood, somebody was using a vacation rental to run drugs. In Nu'uanu, I recall interviewing a family and they said, gosh, they would get knocks on the door at 10 o'clock at night because someone was dropping off someone, you know, and they thought it was their vacation rental. But guess what? It was around the street, you know. So those kinds of things where you're just getting caught up in something that was really not your plan. You're just basically sitting at home. And then, you know, you've had this business crop up in the neighborhood, and then there are unintended consequences in some cases.
Yes, and that is something we are against on Oahu. Our makeup is a little different than neighbor islands because they do have some neighborhoods that have hotels, condos, and single-family homes. We don't really have that on Oahu. They're kind of separated. And we are against whole home rentals on Oahu. That's, you know, it's our neighborhoods are not set up for that type of industry. But we do support a limited number of hosted rentals where the owner's on site. You're not going to have the same issues, and they can be there to enforce if there's bad behavior. So they're right there.
So what can you say about the situation in Maui, in Lahaina?
It breaks our heart, really. It's painful, you know, for all of us, I think.
Yeah, I mean, we're all a part of that community in some way. You know, we all know somebody who's lost either a loved one or lost a home or a business. I mean, it's been really tough. You know, since the ban is no longer in play, what do you want to say about that situation there in Lahaina?
Well, in Lahaina, we all have to help. We just do. So, and it's not just vacationers. We all have to help. And I think locally, we all want to. So we support them, and we do encourage our owners, and many of them did give up their homes for free. We gave up our home for free, like we did at COVID. We gave our home for free to doctors who needed, you know, they were living with loved ones who were immunocompromised.
High risk, yes.
Yep, so doctors stayed in our house because they were living with elderly parents. So they couldn't go home.
And so the push to phase out vacation rentals there in Maui?
You know, it's a big part of their budget. It is. And a lot of people rely on that income, not only the owners. And I can understand the thought that they're all mainlanders. But they're not all. So it's kind of throwing out the baby with the bathwater, kind of, you know, like, we have to be smart about it. And we agree with the governor that we have to protect our local residents first and foremost. But there is a need for short, mid, and long-term rentals. And banning something altogether could cause some chaos and ripple effects that they're unintended. They don't realize now how that could affect the people who rely on the income, not just the owners, but all the cleaners and the ancillary businesses who will then not be able to stay in Hawaii and then further the exodus. And we don't want that. So we have to be very diligent and make sure that we're not taking it too fast and too strong, but taking it step by step and not being reactionary, being proactive and saying, okay, how do we make this work for everybody? How do we make it fair and balanced for everybody?
There's a place for vacation rentals in our economy.
Yes, we are a visitor destination. It's our, you know, tourism is our number one economic driver. We know that. So it's hard to say we need tourists to come back. We don't want you here. That's not what we want to promote.
Right. Mixed messages.
Yes.
There.
We're the land of aloha. We have to remain.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Kelly. I really appreciate you carving out time for us this morning.
It's been an honor speaking with you. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. That was Kelly Lee, who is with the Hawaii Alliance of Short and Midterm Vacation Rentals Owners. That alliance formed last spring. It has members across the state. This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz.
Unihoa, ulehua, unihau, ukauai, oahu, umolokai, ulanai, umau, ukahoolabe, uhavai.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we'll jump back in aviation history to shine the spotlight on a pioneer who set many records, including being the first female aviator to fly solo across the Atlantic Ocean. Born on July 24, 1897 in Kansas, Amelia Earhart knew she wanted to fly at an early age. At the age of 25, she became the 16th woman in the world to earn a pilot's license. It was in 1928 that famous pilot Charles Lindbergh asked Earhart to make a solo flight across the Atlantic, which she completed successfully. That accomplishment brought her international fame. Several years later, she attempted to be the first female pilot to fly around the world, and we all know how that ended, with one of the most mysterious disappearances in history. That mystery actually began here in Hawaii, and our question today is, which landing strip in Hawaii played a part in Earhart's fateful attempt to circumnavigate the world? Call 808-941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. Pick up a reusable HPR tote bag if you're the first one to get it right.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing access to affordable housing to those with intellectual and developmental disabilities, including ARC of Maui County. NareitHawaii.com.
Curb Your Enthusiasm presents its finale Sunday night on Max. On the next Fresh Air, we feature our interviews with Larry David, who stars and created it, Cheryl Hines, who played his wife and then ex-wife, Jeff Garland, who plays his manager and best friend, and Susie Essman, who plays Garland's wife and David's nemesis. And TV critic David Bianculli has an appreciation. Join us.
Beginning this afternoon at 3.
Support for HPR comes from the Scheidler College of Business at UH Manoa, with an info session for Master of Science in Finance, Marketing Management, and Information Systems on April 24th. Scheidler.hawaii.edu.
The Last Resort is an exhibit featuring black and white photographs of people in and around Lahaina. It recently concluded its run at the Chapel Gallery in British Columbia, Canada. It's the work of photographer Arifin Graham and was named after the song by the Eagles. The photographs were taken in 2022 and feature images of everyday people in their element doing everyday things. His photographs have taken on a new context in the wake of last August's wildfires. In addition to being celebratory, they are now historical. The conversations of Russell Subiono talk with Graham about his photography.
I was born in England, grew up near Calgary, Alberta, on a ranch. And my first experience of Hawaii was being taken to Waikiki at the age of about 4 years old in 1960. And that's where I got the smells and the feel of the water and the sound of the music. And I realized through this that that's where my love of Hawaii really began as a young boy. And then I went to school, back east in Ontario. And then I went to San Francisco Art Institute to study photography in the sort of mid to late 70s. And it was actually my father who really got me interested in photography initially as a boy. And then I studied at San Francisco Art Institute with a guy called Perkel Jones, who was a longtime friend and associate of Ansel Adams, the great American landscape photographer. And Perkel did a project with Dorothea Lange, another great American photographer from the 20th century, called The Death of a valley that was being flooded in Napa County, California, for a reservoir in the 1950s. And Dorothea Lange was commissioned by Life magazine to document the last year of this valley, this beautiful valley, this rich farming community and town that was there, and they were being evicted, you know, because California needed the water. And that influenced me hugely. And that piece of work that they did, documenting a community that they knew was going to disappear. And then I didn't do black and white photography for about 40 years. But I always sort of kept in mind that I was doing black and white street photography in the 1970s in San Francisco. And I sort of left that behind. And then one day in Lahaina, 2 years ago right now in April, it was Earth Day, April 22nd. I was down at the end of Lahaina where Mala Wharf is. And I just saw these three images, one, two, three. And I just felt that these were really compelling images. They're of local people. And I knew that this was going to be an interesting portfolio of work and that it would be called The Last Resort, which is named after the Eagles song from 1976, right, in which Lahaina figures hugely.
You can leave it all behind. You sail to Lahaina just like the missionaries did so many years ago.
And the song is about how we find paradise and kiss it goodbye.
They call it paradise. I don't know why. You call someplace paradise. Kiss it goodbye.
And I always felt that song was an important song environmentally, socially, culturally, and really foretold. You know, as Don Henley said, it's the history of Western civilization in 7 minutes. And then Lahaina figures so deeply and prominently in the song as being the last resort. You know, we can leave it all behind and sail to Lahaina. And then, alas, what they were writing about at that time, you know, really came true last year. And so I felt that as a photographer, as an artist, and just as a human being, I had spent many years in Lahaina. My parents had a place there, which really that love of the Aloha spirit, of Maui, of Lahaina, of paddling, you know, all those things that we love to do there. And at the same time, I got to know people who live and work there because my parents had a place. At one point, we needed to fix it up. Our rental agent said, you know, we can't rent it anymore. You got to fix it up. So it was my job to find the tilers and the plumbers and the drywallers and the painters and the handyman. Darren, he was fantastic. And all these people who I engaged to do this work, and I would make trips from Canada to Maui and we'd get this work done. So I really got to know and appreciate people who live and work in Maui and who also keep that place going for the millions of people who come from around the world who absolutely love the place. It was all that that really prepared me for this moment, which was kind of like an epiphany of seeing these three images down at the end of Mala Wharf, three different images of people doing different things. It was that that really was the foundation that allowed me to see Lahaina and see Maui in a certain way and with love. Really, to me, that's kind of the basis, the love of this place that I think is what really is the catalyst that propelled me to do it. And then the work just continued as I met people around Lahaina and around Maui. And I always ask people, may I take your photograph? And there's that wonderful moment of engagement with people, who I've only just met, maybe I've met them a few times. There's that moment of engagement where we really just as human beings, we are there for that moment. And then something of their life, their spirit, their humanity is revealed.
I thought it was very interesting that in many of your photographs in this exhibit, people are aware of the camera. How did that change the nature of the experience, especially in today's context?
Yeah. So 2 years ago, Maui was a very different place. It was a place where a guy like me, who I'm not a resident, I'm a visitor, could go around town and it was just whatever I was doing. When I met Kevin in the Ed 76 gas station, when I met Joni, who was at the Salvation Army, and when I met Kirk Bowes at the Lahaina Art Society at the Banyan Tree Gallery in the old Lahaina courthouse, I think people were really open to it. And I think it's a matter of being sensitive and finding a way of, I'm there to be with them, not to sort of take something away, if you will. My wife and I are coming back to Maui in a couple of weeks. We haven't been there since 2022. And people ask me, you know, what's the next stage of this project? What are you going to do next? And honestly, Russell, I don't know what's next. It's to be revealed. At the same time, I know that there is a particular sensitivity in Maui. And I understand there's even a sign in the airport, at Kahului Airport, that asks people to be very sensitive. Please be aware. This is a very, very hard time for a lot of people. So for me, as a photographer who really liked to engage and for that moment of engagement with people, I don't know what that looks like now. And it has to be done very carefully. And I don't even know if it's possible now. One thing I think about is seeing if I can find some of the people who I photographed and to check in with them, be able to say hello and say, hey, how's it going?
As you were taking your photographs, and I read that you took them over, I think, a couple of different trips back in 2022. Yes. What were you looking for as you were taking them?
I think I was just looking for authenticity and to look at a place that so many people consider paradise. And it really is. It truly is a kind of a paradise for we human beings, you know, globally. It's kind of what we think of. But it's authenticity and it's looking at the place in a way that I think people often don't look at it. You know, these are certainly not touristic photographs. Yes, I have a lovely beach photograph, but for the most part, it's really finding that moment of authenticity and seeing people who perhaps are not always seen by visitors. It might be the person, you need to go into the gas station, you're paying for the gas. It's just a person there doing a transaction. It's a transactional thing. Whereas what I'm looking for is the relationship and seeing people who they're looking around and recognizing people for their humanity and for their individual life, no matter what they're doing. And certainly to engage with the local people. And that goes back to the people I met who live and work in Maui and really trying to just find that authenticity and see the place from a different point of view, you know, not normally seen, I think.
Now that your photographs have kind of this new historical context that really shined a light on what Lahaina was like before the fires, is there any chance or any opportunity that you might be able to bring your exhibit to Maui or to Hawaii at least?
Well, thank you, Russ. I really appreciate that question. Well, when I was there in 2022, I met Jonathan Yukio Clark, who is now the director, I understand, of the Schaefer International Gallery. And I told him in 2022, it was at a photographic workshop, and I said, Jonathan, I've been working on this series of black and white photographs of Lahaina and, you know, like to make a proposal for an exhibition. And so he said, November 30th is when you need to get it in by, just send it on in. So I actually missed the timing for 2022. And then, of course, the fire on August the 8th last year happened, and all of a sudden the photographs have a far greater historical importance. And so I didn't miss that due date last November. I certainly got it in and haven't heard anything back yet. However, I have perhaps hoped to check in with Jonathan while we're over just to see how things are going. But I'd love to be able to show the pictures there. And at the same time, I'm sensitive about timing because I know that emotions are, there's so much destabilization in people's lives. And so is it the right time for these pictures? Or is it a bit later? I don't know. That would really be for those in Maui to understand that, because I think it's so important that the number one thing is, how are people doing? How can we help in that rather than adding burden? Or if these photographs are seen as being interesting or useful or you know, of interest to people to see, then what would the timing be as well? I think that's important. But I'd love to share the photographs with people in Maui and any of the islands, really. And I think it is important that we see the places that we know and love, because environmentally, the world is changing. And let's do what we can to record the places that we know, the people, and also do what we can to make this a good world for our future generations.
Thanks so much for your time this morning.
Great to talk with you. Thanks so much. Aloha.
That was photographer Arifin Graham talking with HPR's Russell Subiono about his Maui-focused exhibit entitled The Last Resort. Now it's time to land the answer for today's Backyard Quiz. Earlier, we delved into the exploits of aviation pioneer Amelia Earhart. Although people are aware of her mysterious fate, many don't know that there was an incident in Hawaii which resulted in changing the original route. Earhart's initial westward bound plan had her beginning in Oakland, California on March 17th, 1937. From there, she flew west to Hawaii. On March 20th, she and her crew ran into issues during takeoff on the leg from Hawaii to Holland Island, the most difficult of the journey. The plane's landing gear collapsed and a wheel blew out. The damage would require drastic maintenance, taking 2 months to complete. Because the plane would not be fixed until summer, Earhart switched gears and rerouted her trip to fly east in the Northern Hemisphere. This time they would begin in Miami on June 1, 1937. That crash took place on Oahu's Ford Island runway, which was the answer we were looking for today. And our winner today is Sun from Pearl City. That's our quiz. If you have an idea for one, send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for HPR comes from Mobi, a Hawaii wireless company serving the island since 2005, committed to providing personal service to each customer, featuring a locally based customer care team. Learn more at mobi.com.
We crave connections. It's human nature to want to know what's happening in your community, in the news, and with each other. And we need those connections now more than ever. Member-supported Hawaii Public Radio helps keep you connected, engaged, and enriched. Wherever you are, whatever's happening in the world, stay connected on the HPR app or ask your smart speaker to play Hawaii Public Radio.
Beyonce's new album, Cowboy Carter, broke 2024 streaming records and has me ready to throw on a 10-gallon hat. But for all its charm, parts of the album feel like Beyonce is still seeking approval from music institutions like the CMAs and the Grammys. But why does Beyonce, arguably the queen of pop, even need their approval to begin with? Next time on It's Been a Minute from NPR.
Beginning Saturday at noon.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Hastings and Pleadwell, a communication company.
This happens to be the year of the forest bird, and we know we have lots of fans of the Mono Minute listening out there. Well, today we are happy to share a web hub for educators and bird lovers aimed at our keiki to help learn about our native birds. We talked to Josh Atwood. He's the education and information specialist at the Department of Land and Natural Resources. And we were talking about a new program to do just that. If you are lucky enough to get on a virtual reality platform, you can get really close to those birds. Here's Atwood.
So we're celebrating forest birds all year long. Listeners of the Manu Minute might know that there are about 84 species of forest bird that were known to occur in Hawaii, and of those, 58 are already extinct, and we'll never hear them again. So of the remaining birds, a lot of them have classifications about being, you know, critically endangered or at risk. And so we are celebrating the birds that help make Hawaii special. And all year long, we are having events that people can go to. We've developed some new educational materials, and we created a web hub where all of the partners that care about birds in Hawaii, we have kind of consolidated their resources. So somebody who wants to celebrate birds this year just goes to this webpage, it's dlnr.hawaii.gov/manu, and they can find curricula, lesson plans, activities for students, and the new one that we released this week is a virtual field trip for Keaho Bird Conservation Center on Hawaii Island.
When you say virtual field trip, then you don't have to fly to the Big Island, but you can still get the experience of what it's like.
Exactly, yeah. So it's 360-degree imagery that we take with a special camera. And then within these spherical photos that you can look around in any direction, we have hotspots that users can click on to play videos where we interview experts that talk about working with the birds at this care facility. You can click on hotspots to learn more about specific bird species or what they eat. And you can hear audio of the birds in that center. And some of the video we took, we also took in a 360-degree format. So as you're moving through the stops on this virtual field trip, you're learning about what the scientists at this center do to care for these birds that are at the center, you know, veterinarian practices and raising food for the birds that are in their care. But then you actually go into the aviaries of these rare birds. And this is not something you could do for an in-person field trip. Even the students that are lucky enough to be on Hawaii Island and might get to go to Keoho Bird Conservation Center in person, you can't take a whole classroom into an aviary for a critically endangered bird, of which there's only a handful left in the wild. And so our virtual field trip is really the only way to kind of experience what it's like for these birds that are temporarily in care and then will hopefully be re-released back into the forest later.
So you really want to get the word out to the teachers, because if they've got curriculum that they're planning and they can use this as a resource, it's there.
Absolutely. Yeah, the field trips are open to everybody. We do make them with students in mind. So we're working with the Department of Education and trying to align our field trips with academic standards, particularly the next generation science standards. And so they are ideal for classrooms to take as a group or for students to explore on their own. But you don't have to be a student, K through 12. Any age person can go on our website and take this virtual field trip.
So do you have a favorite bird?
I do. My favorite bird, it's hard to choose, but I'd have to go with the akoekoe. It's a critically endangered bird on Maui, and it's also called the crested honeycreeper. And if you see a photo of this bird, it's just incredible. It has this amazing, like, almost hairstyle on top of its head with white and red and orange feathers on top of a black-purple body. It's wild. It's a beautiful, unique bird.
Well, I'm partial to the Manoku, and it's all white, but we see a lot of them flying around our studio here, and so, I'm kind of a partial to them. And they've got a festival coming up later this month.
That's right, and we'll be there. So we're actually at a number of events this month. April is Earth Month, and so Forestry and Wildlife and a lot of our partners that care about birds in Hawaii will be at the Party for the Planet at Honolulu Zoo on April 13th. We'll be at the Bishop Museum Science and Sustainability Festival on April 20th, and then we'll be at the Manu'oku Festival on April 27th.
And so while this round of virtual field trips focuses on birds because it's a year of the bird, we do have some available for snails as well.
Yes, yeah. So last year was year of the kahuli, and this year's year of the forest bird. Last year, we created a virtual field trip that you can still find online that goes through the Snail Extinction Prevention Laboratory. And you can see how the scientists there that work for DLNR are caring for these snail species that many of them no longer exist in the wild. They're similar to the birds. They have to be brought into a care facility to prevent them from going extinct. We care for them in those facilities while we work to improve their habitats with the aim of returning them to the landscape once the habitat is safe for them.
And we should mention that the field trip experience is available on virtual reality platform as well?
Yes. So all of our field trips you can view in a web browser, on a computer, tablet, even a smartphone, but they're also VR enabled, meaning that if you have a VR headset or even just a Google Cardboard slot that you put your phone in, you can enter VR mode and you can put it on your face and look around in 360 degrees and feel like you're really there, you know, with the birds in the aviary or in the snail lab. We have field trips to natural area reserves around the state, different locations where you can, if you can't be there in person, the next best thing is to experience it virtually.
I mean, I bet you that is just going to grab the kids. I mean, you know, with technology the way it is, to be able to put on those glasses, right?
Yeah, we've had some good success. We've only been promoting this program with virtual field trips for a little over a year, and we have about 87,000 page views, I believe, across our different virtual field trips. That's each stop within a field trip counts as a page view. And when we go to fairs and festivals, that's when we'll usually bring a virtual reality headset. And we usually have a line, you know, away from our booth of kids just waiting to try this out and see what it's like to be transported to a mountaintop where a lot of our native species are found. Unfortunately, in Hawaii, most of our native species are up Mauka and everybody lives down at lower elevations. So this is a way we can bring nature to them.
We've seen photos of, you know, the scientists out there, you know, atop a cliff, you know, on Kauai, fertilizing a endangered plant. But yeah, this is a way for you to travel there.
Yes, without having to rappel yourself and be on the side of a cliff. It's much safer.
Yeah, particularly if you're afraid of heights like I am. So, well, so then folks can have that opportunity to experience this at any of those events, or they can go online. And if teachers want to know more, they can just go to your website or what, call you. I mean, I don't know if you do anything else, anything special?
Yes. Yeah, we have an educator email list that teachers can sign up for in Hawaii. And as I mentioned, we are working with Department of Education to try to get some of these resources directly to teachers, along with standards, documents, and other things to facilitate their use in the classroom. But any user can go to our website and find these virtual field trips, as well as all the other activities, downloadable crafts and games that we have for Year of the Forest Birds, Maki Kiona Manu Nehele. And we also are offering swag, so people can email us for free water bottle stickers that feature our native birds. You can get a free classroom poster that features some of our endangered forest birds. We just want to get these resources into the hands of teachers and students and anybody else that loves these birds.
Okay, and then you've got, what, half a dozen on the line on the birds right now?
We have half a dozen virtual field trips that are in this 360-degree platform. And we have some older field trips as well that are made with Google Earth, but our new 360 platform, Kula, we have 6 field trips online for different public lands around the state that you might not be able to get to in person. And so this is a way that we can share those resources with people. And we'll be expanding that over the years as we do additional outreach programs and we can get to additional places that we want to share with people. These are all public resources, and we just want to make sure that people have access to them and can understand why they're so special.
And then if there's anybody out there that wants to be like a sponsor of this program, I mean, is there any of that available?
Yeah, you know, we're a state program, and so we're already sponsored by the people of Hawaii, so mahalo. But on our Makihiki Ona Manu Nehele webpage, we have options where people can buy merchandise or donate to support some of our non-state partners or RCUH programs like the Kauai Forest Bird Recovery Project or the Maui Forest Bird Recovery Project or Bishop Museum. So there are definitely ways that people can get involved either through volunteering or through getting, you know, items or donating.
Okay. All right. Well, you're the bird. Happy to help out in any way to get the word out.
Mahalo.
And that was Josh Atwood, Education and Information Specialist with the Department of Land and Natural Resources. We will have links to that web hub and the virtual field trips on our website after the show. That is it for this Aloha Friday. Coming up next week, well, we focus in on the Aloha Harvest Program and why fish is on the menu. Call our talkback line and give us some feedback, 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can listen back to our shows on our webpage or on your favorite podcast platform. Our program is produced by Russell Subiono, Lillian Song, with help from Maddie Bender and Savannah Harriman-Pote. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us on Monday. Pick up the conversation.